This episode of A Few Things with Claire and Erica is brought to you by Bed Bath & Beyond. Hit them up at bedbathandbeyond.com or go to one of their many stores.
I'm Mike Lameco from Food Talk. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to A Few Things with Claire and Erica, the Reading Things edition.
This is the second book club episode that we're doing, and we're really excited about it. So you want to know why?
Why?
Because we actually got the author here.
We are superstars.
No, you know who's the superstar?
Who?
The person who wrote the book, who responded with 36 hours notice to come on our podcast because we're such dummies that it didn't occur to us to do this sooner.
It's true. welcome, Mira Jacob.
Thank you.
We're so excited to have you here. We're so grateful that we emailed you, I think, yesterday. Or the day before,
Monday.
Like last night,
and it was Monday.
And we were like, "Will you come?" And you have a day to decide. Will you come talk about this? And you did it, and that was really nice of you.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here. And my son, who's sitting outside eating pizza, is also thrilled to be here.
We just felt so excited to have the chance to meet him. We were really thrilled that he walked in and was willing to say hi to us.
I had introduced Erica to your son before today, because during the meeting where we got together to plan this episode, I had looked you up to be like, can we get in touch with this person, and had found some really charming videos of your son on the internet.
And your amazing BuzzFeed post that made our newsletter, Michael Jackson BuzzFeed article that is just like so smart and funny.
We linked to that in our newsletter. It's so good. And it's an excerpt from your next book, right?
Yes. Ugh. Yeah. It's my next book. It's called Good Talk, Conversations I'm Still Confused About.
Such a good title.
And the only thing linking all these conversations is that they were things that actual people said to me and I said back. I'm drawing it, actually. I'm drawing the next book.
Yeah, that was what was so amazing. I thought that I've never pegged myself as someone who would like graphic memoirs or graphic novels, and you had this excerpt on BuzzFeed, and I was super into it, and the drawings added so much.
Oh, cool. That's really good to hear, because I'm deep in the mode right now where I'm teaching myself to draw on a computer.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that is interesting.
It's super weird. It's really strange.
Do you have a pad or like a tablet?
I do. I have a tablet, and the best metaphor I can use for it is it's like teaching yourself to brush someone else's teeth.
Whoa.
Nothing intuitive.
Yeah.
Nothing intuitive.
Like upside down and backwards.
Yeah. And the whole time you're like, is this right? Is it working?
Does it feel good for you?
Is that clean in there? I don't know.
You can't just draw it on paper and scan it in.
You can.
I don't think you should do this.
That is how I feel.
That is outrageous.
I would never brush someone else's teeth. You know, you can, but then the editing becomes a totally different thing.
Fair
The way that I made that first installment was I literally made paper puppets and put them on top of Michael Jackson albums.
I recognized your son immediately meeting him in real life because I'd seen those drawings.
You're doing a great job brushing his teeth.
Oh, awesome. I feel great about that.
Yes. Now I want to talk all about that book, but first we're going to talk about Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing, which is the book that you published last year.
Yeah, 2014.
Okay.
And it was your debut novel.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us, you're going to do a better job of this than we will for sure. Can you give everybody the brief synopsis in case they're dummies and they haven't read it yet for some reason? Then after that, they're going to turn off the episode, go read it, and come back.
Exactly. Okay. That's great. And we make sure happens, right?
Yeah.
Like reach out and strangle them.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how iTunes works these days. It's super easy.
Really advanced.
A lot of leverage there. So this is the story of an East Indian family in New Mexico in the 80s. And what happens is it starts with an incident where it's the 90s when it starts, and the mother calls her daughter, Kamala, calls her daughter, Amina, and says, your father is talking to people that don't exist. You need to come home and figure out what's happening. He's talking to people that are not right in front of him. And her daughter says, what do you mean? And she says, he's talking to members of his family. And his family has kind of, you find out, has met a sort of terrible end. So the idea that this would be happening is really disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
So she goes back to New Mexico to find out what happens. And it's really, I think of it as kind of two mysteries that are unwinding at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
One is, is there something really wrong with this father? Because the mother is so unreliable that, you know, anything could be
She's
going
a wildly
on,
right? unreliable narrator in this way. Yeah.
You cannot trust Kamala to say anything. Or anything that makes sense. So part of it is that. And then the other mystery that you're figuring out at the same time is what happened to this family to leave them in the position that they're in now, where he could be hallucinating and he could have these kind of grievances that he needs to address in his present day.
So you're going to read us a section of the book that sort of gets right to the heart of this, right? A little
yes.
passage.
Like, is he having these visions?
Exactly.
Is what's going on?
Yes.
And everybody has turned it off who hasn't read yet. And you're going to pick this up here 5 minutes in.
Or you will start seeing somebody's Indian family.
I think that's a good threat. Yeah.
The ghost of an Indian family coming to you, people. Okay, so this is the part where, so there's a kind of an extended family in this, mm-hmm. and they're not blood related, and I think that's an important thing, because this
family... We are going to get into that.
Family in this country anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Family in this country anyway, and so this is a scene in which Sanji, the quote-unquote aunt, has finally confronted Amina and said, your family has not talked to us for a month, we don't know what's going on, these are people that talk every day, every other day. You have to tell us what's going on, and Amina is starting to tell her, I think something really is wrong with my dad. He went to the hospital. He's had some bad test results. So, this is them sitting in the kitchen. Sanji tugged her nose, looking perplexed. And you say he's seeing things? Yeah. What things? Just, you know, Amina shifted, like hallucinations. Rabbits? What? No, people. His family in India. Sanji's mouth fell open. The ones who burned up in that fire? Yeah, although not just them. Apparently he had an incident at the hospital, which is part of the reason he's not working right now. Amina stopped talking, feeling protective of her father's standing in the family. Sanji looked at her watch. So, they'll be there all morning? Yeah, good. She looked around the kitchen, as if checking off a to-do list, and shoved one last good bite of caramel cream in. So I'll just go and sit with them. Wait, now? Of course! Well, I mean, they don't even know you know, and I'm not sure if they want anyone there to... Too bad. I'm going. And when the others know, they'll come. Enough is enough. 1 month of hiding and you'll all be mad, no? And then where will we be? But, Sanji, auntie... No butting! You really think this is... They're going to be so upset? Ridiculous. I just think... No thinking! I'm gonna eepen! You listen to me, okay? We are all we have here. Do you understand? That is it. And we could talk all about good times and wouldn't it be nice to go back, but none of us is ever going back. To what? To who? Our own families can't even stand us for longer than a few days. No. We are home already, like it or not, and that's how we... She gulped furiously. Your parents, she began again. They welcomed us, no? Raj and I, all those 1 million years ago. Didn't give one sticky fig about who we were or where we came from. Just invited us over for samosas and poof! Instant family. Bond made. And like that, we'll go on, nah?
Yes.
So good. Yeah, it really gets to the heart of...
Totally.
Of one of the things that really struck us about this book, it was that... The family in this country anyway. And it was funny because it's something we've both talked about before, this Indian custom of the auntie.
Yeah.
And that's not your parents' sister.
Yes, right.
And I didn't have anything like that growing up. I had my real aunts, and then my parents were so busy raising kids and working that they didn't really we didn't have like a network of sort of like friends in my family. And I always have thought that that's so beautiful and something I would want for my family, because it's incredible. In this book, you don't even actually know, kind of until that point, that not everybody's related. Like somebody you have, there's a character that is her cousin, and at no point until like 3/4 of the way through is it mentioned that it's not actually her cousin.
Right. Right. No. And I think, I mean, it's sort of... It's kind of family as survival mechanism, right?
Totally.
Because these are people who, like my parents, who moved to New Mexico mm-hmm. in the late 60s, they didn't have anyone. And it's so funny when you say that now with the internet and every other, you know, mechanical way to talk mm-hmm. to people. Then in those days, you left and you did not see your family again for years, mm-hmm. right?
Completely.
So, And I remember this because we used to, this is going to make me sound like I'm 1,000 years old, but we used to wait by the phone on Saturdays to get the phone call.
Yeah. Totally. My husband is Czech, and his parents moved from the Czech Republic when he was, you know, before he was born.
Right.
And had that very same experience of, like, you talked at a set time sort of every week, and that was how this relationship was forged. And even the idea of talking on the phone was, like, kind of a huge revelation.
Absolutely. And the idea that you would have anyone to catch you if you fell was then sort of just, it's not something that they had in their lives,
yes.
right? So my parents, when they came, and, you know, around the same time that the people in the family came, they came to New Mexico, and they had enough money for basically a month.
Yeah. Mm.
And after that, it was just like, well, if you don't make it, you don't make it, and there's not another option for you. So I think that's how these bonds formed. And I grew up with a situation like this, with aunts and uncles mm-hmm. and many, actually, quote-unquote, cousins.
Yeah.
And there's something really nice about that, in that we're not related, so it is just love that bonds mm-hmm. us. And I know them much better than I know my blood relatives, for the most part, which is complicated.
I have a sort of naive question, though. Is that same sort of pseudo-familial but not actually familial network mirrored with families in India and friends? Or was that a product of the fact that you didn't have your real family?
No, that's
family?
A product yeah. of the fact that you don't have. Because in India, when we go back, frankly, it's very traditional, and it's very hard to break those boundaries. For example, for us, one of our very close families, we're a Syrian Christian family. Mm-hmm. Our very, very close friends are Hindus. Mm-hmm. They're of a completely different part of society. That wouldn't have happened in India. Sure, we might have been friends.
Mm-hmm. But you would not have had the relationship that you have now.
No yeah. way. No yeah. way. And I think, you know, I mean, to that point, my brother actually married a Gujarati girl, which all of us were like, oh, my God, he married her. You know, because we're from New Mexico, and there were, like, yeah. four other Indians. And we're like, he found one of his own. Anyway, but we were all quite impressed with that, having never had anyone around us. And then I told one uncle of mine in India, he's like, well, nobody's talking what the real problem is. And I was like, what's the real problem? He's like, well, she's a Guju, and so nobody's saying she's not really like us. And I was like, oh, man. You have no idea yeah. how many levels of not really like us there are out there. Like, this is golden.
That's amazing. Well, you also, I think, like, a nice complimentary read to this book is the essay you had published in Vogue, I guess, last year or the year before, about your yeah. parents' arranged marriage, and you sort of, you know, coming to understand the love that could be created in a marriage like that, and your complicated feelings around how that works and where it doesn't work.
Yeah, you know, it was really surprising, because if you grow up in America, you're sort of raised on rom-coms, and if you think mm-hmm. those mess up American women, which they do.
For sure.
Yeah.
With an Indian who has grown up with an arranged marriage in their family, it's just catastrophic.
Yeah.
You know, because you have this idea of, like, if I just find the right American, mm-hmm. all montages are possible. and then you have your own parents, and they're sort of awkward. My parents were, I always thought of them as, I wrote this in the piece, but as these kind of ice skaters, this kind yeah. of careful distance held mm-hmm. between them. They were so good at moving in sync, but there was a palpable coolness
mm-hmm. right.
between them. Yeah. And, you know, occasionally I would understand that they were really into each other the way they fought, mm-hmm. weirdly, because you don't fight like that unless you really care yeah. about what the other person thinks.
Yeah.
So I would see this evidence of heat. But yeah, my parents fell in love when I was 23.
Wow. Which is pretty late in, you know.
Yeah. Pretty late yeah. in the game, yeah. No, and they had had, you know, they had been together at that point, like, 30 years. So, yeah. I mean, it's funny. If you tell me, my mother would not be appreciating me saying this, because yeah. she'd be like, I don't know what you're saying. But it was obvious to me. It was obvious to my brother. Mm-hmm. I called my brother in a total panic, and I was like, dude, they are in love. I don't know what is happening. There is footsie going on. They
and
are,
it's weird.
I know. I mean, I'd yeah. never seen them hold hands, and I walked in on them kissing, and I was like, I'm going to die. What just happened?
Well, this raises a question. So the mother and father in the book are not an arranged marriage, right?
Right, no.
Okay, but they got married really quickly.
They got married really okay. quickly, and Thomas is an impulsive man, and he met her, and he fell in love with her, and they got married, and so they already were a little bit doing the, you know, the not quite followed path, and then they moved to New Mexico, mm-hmm. where there was nobody, and then they are very different people.
Yeah.
One of the things that you, I think, speak to so well in the book is the sort of like struggle of dealing with or expressing emotion, and you know, the way that different people like address these things, and you know, that Kamala like lashes out and isn't expressing what she feels at all or what she thinks is happening, and that Amina has so much trouble, you know, expressing to Jamie how she feels about him. And in your Vogue article, you also sort of get at those ideas as being like at the heart of who you are.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what's so funny is, so I found Amina a kind of interesting and frustrating character, because there were so many times where I wanted to just say, like, just do something, but, just push her a little bit. I'm way more of like, if this is like Sex and the City, we could say we're a Miranda or a Carrie. I'm way more of a Dimple than Amina. So there were times when I was writing her, I was like, I can't believe you're not going to just jump at this or do something.
That's how I felt.
Right. Yeah. It's just a little frustrating, but also I felt like that's a really interesting character to explore, because I think so many of us go through these kind of deep jolting pains in life, and we reform around them.
Yes.
And she's somebody that has reformed around something that she kind of holds herself responsible.
Her brother's death,
which in this way that is that's really dismantling for her.
Yeah.
And I think as a person reading the book, you can understand it wasn't really her, but it maybe was a little bit all of them. They are a little bit complicit. And so I think that her way out of that has just been a stunted way forward.
Yeah. Well, she's an incredibly well-rounded character for somebody you didn't identify with in that way. Cause you understand where that stunt is coming from very clearly. It makes sense.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Something we both related to so much is her relationship with her father and the way that they bond and the things they talk about and the things that they don't talk about and the way that they show love, which just felt so real.
Erica pulled out a line. You should just read it, Erica, because also I don't... It's not on our
worksheet.
No, I thought it was, but it's about the... here it is. I found it. Amina's eyes filled with tears. It was a distinctly feminine humiliation, the kind daughters close to their fathers go to great pains to avoid, as betraying of their fragility as a stain on the back of a skirt. And it was like, for me, that was such a powerful term to put words to this idea that like you can still be humiliated in front of your father as a grown woman, sometimes maybe more so, for these very emotional moments that you definitely experienced, you know, all the time as a child. And that was part of what made this book so tragic for me, was because ultimately the father dies and you know he's going to, and that was so hard.
I started this book with a totally different father when I was writing it. And it was this great character, and I was in, and everyone was sort of settled into their places. And then 3 years into writing the book, my father got cancer and started dying, though he didn't know it then. And I think what happened in that moment was so funny, because it sort of crystallized a lot of things about our relationship. One of the hard things about losing a parent is you just have the relationship that you have with them. There is no more story to write.
Yeah. Right.
Right. And so this thing that you are up against in some way every day in your life, this thing that you have defined yourself against, suddenly freezes into amber, and finding your energy around that is really hard, surprisingly hard, especially when you formed your identity kind of hitting up against it all the
time. Well, and that is kind of what you write, is that they, in those final like days and weeks and months, what they're doing is just solidifying that dynamic over and over again, right? It's like they're just replaying, all of them, you know, the Kamala and Amina, they're just replaying that dynamic into, like you said, amber.
You know, and the thing is that, so when you, and I hope neither of you have lost a parent to cancer, but when you lose somebody close in your life to cancer, it's not, no one ever wants to lose anyone in any way, but especially because my dad was a doctor and he knew it was coming at every moment, and it was so hard.
Watching him come to terms with that himself and knowing before anybody in his family did what it all meant.
This was like one of the most stunning parts of the book for me, because I have this, like, I call it a condition, and it has like I swear to God, I've told so many therapists and they're like, that is so weird. I just constantly worry that everybody I love is gonna die, like constantly.
I do it too. I know this is something we've talked about.
It's like crippling, and therapists are really like, why are you doing that? Like, stop.
Really?
Yes.
And I do it too.
It's like, well, so what I found very intense about your book was that you basically tell us up front who's going to die. and not as much with the father, but especially with Akil, you say pretty early on that he's going to die. And then I kept waiting for him to die. And it wasn't until
you were like chest clenchy.
I had a huge release when he finally did die, because it was so much more painful to read all the scenes, you know, where he was alive, knowing that he was going to die. And I was just curious about that decision to basically make it very clear to everybody up front that, you know, these characters are going to die.
You know what's so funny? So I wrote this book, and we should also tell the readers who are listening despite not having read the book and who are like, I'm never reading this book. It's very funny.
Oh my God, it's so funny.
We've got to get to the humor. It's so funny.
You heard the rabbit line, everybody. Yeah.
But I think the thing about that and specifically writing about deciding to put that up front. Mm-hmm. With the first draft, I actually didn't say that he died. Mm-hmm. And I sort of hinted around it a little bit. And then somebody said, like, you've got to just say it. Like, I've got to
just
know.
Well, what's weird is I was pretty much knew Itty was going to die long before he did. And it was mostly because I was like, I think he's so charming he couldn't possibly live.
Survive this book.
Yeah. I know. one of my favorite, you're never supposed to read reviews. And somebody told me, don't ever go on Goodreads and read a review. And of course, God. So then immediately I was like, what's good? Oh, I'm going to go read them. So immediately I take like the one star, there's probably several by now, but there was a 1-star review and I clicked on it and it was like, if given the chance, Mira Jacob would kill every single character in her midst.
Like, you should, you should get that printed as a poster. It's really too good.
I'm like, am I that person? I never thought I was a person that would like walk into a story and kill everybody. but yeah, it is funny because I think what I was trying to do, one thing is the thing that happened when my dad died is I was writing this book, mm-hmm. and I put it away in the 3 years that he was dying because I could not face it. Also because I think the process of writing is one where you have to have a lot of possibilities, and emotional possibilities for what could happen. Otherwise, scenes feel really dead, right? Mm-hmm. So a scene has to be able to surprise you. And the problem with when someone in your life is dying is that is the only surprise you can hold on to. Like all the rest of the things that are happening, you're like, I can't take any more mm-hmm. insecurity. I can't imagine the rooms. And I used to picture myself weirdly as I didn't actually, this movie wasn't out then, but it was, I swear it was my mental frame reference. Do you know the the Grand Hotel Budapest?
Yes.
Okay, that big hotel.
Yeah.
So I pictured my internal life before my dad got sick as I was the Grand Budapest Hotel mm-hmm. when I was a younger writer. I had rooms, I had levels, I had floors, I had secret passages. I had all sorts of just business going on and I could focus on any single thing and just, and it would come out.
Fill it up.
And when he died, when we got like worse prognosis after worse prognosis, I felt like it was like floor after floor just started going dark. Like the top floor went dark and then the middle and then they just started going dark one by one until by the end of the whole thing I felt like I was like a person on a bicycle hooked up to a generator just like pedaling for life to just stay lit in this one small place. And so the process of writing for me was a lot about going back to those rooms and those floors and flipping on the lights.
Totally.
I mean, like, what happened here?
Right.
Like, what happened to take me this far from myself? So I ended up putting my dad in the book, which is a really weird thing to do when you have a different father that you start with. But I started writing it again, and I could not stop writing him. And I was writing the most messed up things because it was like his hands. Mm-hmm. I missed his hands. I missed our fights. I miss the, you know, like when people always lionize someone who's dead. They're always like, oh, he was a saint. My father was so not a saint and I missed.
And that's why he was wonderful. Like that's who he is.
I missed the not a saintness. I missed the person I got to fight with. So anyway, to answer your question in a really long way.
No.
That's what I did put Akil in and I knew Akil was going to die early on. But I kind of let those things as they mounted. There were days when I would write this and I would be crying too. I was like, I can't believe what's happening to these people. This is terrible.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and this is just to make things dark for another minute.
I want to stick with death too.
Yeah. Can we talk about how you handled Thomas's death and how all that came together? We were talking about it the other day and I had lost an aunt last year and she was in hospice and had a sort of similar like a similar kind of end, the end that Thomas has. And we were talking about the book, Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. Have you read it?
I haven't. I know it's supposed to be amazing. You should read it.
Okay. It's very cathartic too. Like more cathartic than I thought it was going to be after going through all of that. It just felt like an interesting way to think about death as a thing that we all experience, but also a system and healthcare and the consequences
of it. The idea of sustaining an uncomfortable life versus giving somebody a comfortable end of life.
Completely.
Wow.
Yeah. And what happens in the book very much like follows, I think,
crystallizes that.
Like, yeah. That idea that like being, you know, living isn't necessarily always the biggest win that there is, that there are other things that could be more fulfilling than that. And at the end of this book, the dad, you know, doesn't go to a hospital and, you know, sort of dies in his backyard, living with these visions that he's having, these visions that are making him so happy.
Yeah.
How did you come to that place for him?
You know, that was a, that was some deep fantasy for how I wish it would have ended. I wish it would have ended really poetically, and it did in a way, but it was rough. And my dad called me up. My actual dad in real life called me up in November of 2006 and said, "What are you doing on December 9th? And I said, "I don't know. Why? What are you doing?" And he said, "I think I'm done. I think I want to be done." And so I knew, and I said, do you have a way to do that? And he said, yes. And I said, okay. And so I knew when I left that I was flying home to help him. And it was, I mean, the crazy thing about that, I'll tell you, which was so shocking, is that what happened is, you know, he's obviously in the medical community, had some friends who helped him put together something. And we had all planned on December 9th. And the first night I was home, I'm always making him laugh, and he was laughing. He was eating something, and he was laughing over the dinner table, and he started choking, and I smacked his back, and I broke something, and I know because his eyes got really wide, and I said, "Daddy, Dad, what did I do? What did I do?" And he just looked at me, and I said, "What did I do?" And he said, "You didn't do anything." But what I did, which I found out the next day, is I punctured his lung because I'd broken his rib, and it had punctured his lung. And that actually is the thing that ended up killing him. And in two more weeks, he would have had to do it himself. So it was a blessing, right? Yeah. It was a blessing that he went out laughing.
Yeah.
It was a blessing that he was with us, and it was
like fully present and got to experience that.
And it was kind of, I know it was merciful, but it was also, I had a really hard time afterward because it was at my hands, the person that I love most.
Yeah.
And that was, it was hard to kind of, it's not that he was going to live much longer. It's not like there was some great life waiting for him. He was going to go, but it was just really hard to know that it was me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was when he was laughing, and it was like, even in the moment that you love someone the most, you know, that thing can happen. So when I was writing, to answer that question, when I was writing, it was a fantasy of, had it all just gone the way we had planned.
Mm-hmm.
Had he gotten to choose exactly how it happened?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that he would actually choose different, but I wanted that for somebody. I wanted that for the character of Thomas. I wanted him to go out the way he wanted to.
Well, what it is, and yeah, if you haven't read the book, I'm spoiling it. And if you have read the book, you already know this, but he gets to be with his son, his dead son, which is, you know, all he's wanted for however many years at this point. And at first I was as furious as Amina with Kamala for not, you know, pushing him to get treatment. But then it on a dime, you're like, wait, actually, this makes total sense.
I get what's happening.
Why would you take this away from him? Why would you take, you know, he's dying, but also he gets to be with his son. And why would you, you know, take that away?
I know. This is the thing about Kamala that was always surprised. Kamala was like her own. Kamala, I've never met a Kamala before in my life. Mm-hmm. There's nobody in my life. She just came into the story like fully formed and then dictated everything, dictated all the terms. And when I was writing it, I would try to write a scene and I'd be like, now Kamala's going to do this. And if Kamala didn't want to do it, I would hear Kamala going, "No, I'm not doing that. I wouldn't do that." Like, she would just like sit behind me and I was like, "Oh my God, you're going to drive me crazy." But I would write whatever she wanted, basically. And that, the thing that I thought was so great about her as a character, and I do feel like she's more someone that I stumbled into than someone I made up, because she always kind of did the right thing in a very weird way.
Yeah, and you just didn't know she was going to do the right thing until she had, like, gone so far down that road. And she was like, no, dummy, of course I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, she had a really weird, funny logic that always rose up to, like, meet her family in the right place, even though she was a disaster day to day.
The thing I was curious about with Kamala and it was consistent with her character, but she, like, doesn't believe in depression, right? Like, multiple times, she's like, he's not depressed. That's crazy. And just, like, brushes it away. And how does that sort of speak to her character?
Oh, I think that's also a very Indian thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like, yeah. That doesn't happen to us. You know, it's that kind of thing.
It's
like,
it's the demons, dummy. It's not depressed.
Exactly. Yeah. And in India, it would just be like, no, maybe he's having some stomach bug.
Yeah.
He's not depressed. Like, no, he's depressed. He's actually depressed. It's a thing. We have it as a people. We can get depressed. But Kamala is definitely of that kind of, no, it's not happening that way. It's happening this way. Like, she needs to even dictate the terms of everyone else's demise, even. You know, they can't just fail on their own. It has to be sanctioned by Kamala.
Which character in your book has the best sense of humor?
Oh, God. Has the best sense of humor, or is like just funniest. The funniest Kamala? I think that's the funniest too.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think Kamala actually has a sense of humor, though.
Not
I don't
at all.
Know that Kamala right. knows how funny she is, right. but I thought she was hilarious.
Yeah,
agreed.
I just thought so
she's a nut, and she just run around and do these crazy things. And sometimes I just was like, oh my God, there you are again, being crazy.
Something that we did on the last episode of the podcast was the last reading things episode of the podcast was talk about casting. Who would be in the movie?
Oh my God. Wait, can we talk about this? Because everyone that reads this book says to me, this needs to be a movie, right?
Yeah, obviously.
Okay, and do you know what I hear? I don't know if you know, I talk about this a lot right now. Diversity in publishing is a big thing.
No, but this is what we want to talk
about.
This
is why we're here.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Because what I am told over and over again, I just don't even know what to do with this anymore, is people keep saying to me, there just aren't enough Indians to make this movie. Just aren't enough Indian actors to really make this a thing. And
which
I'm like,
insane.
Which is so wildly frustrating.
Like, have you seen how big that country is?
Does that make you want to pull your hair out? Does that make you want to pull your hair out more than anything? Yeah.
It's so frustrating. Because I just, when these people say this, I just want to say, like, because I grew up here in the 80s and the 90s, and people were so starved for Indians on screen that I remember seeing the screening of Fire, which is so not a child appropriate movie. Okay, there are people having, like, you know, it's just it's violent, it's desperately sad, and there were people there cradling their 3-year-olds because they just wanted their kids to see people that looked like them on screen. And meanwhile, I feel like this is so relatable.
Yes.
And it's something that so many different kinds of people go through.
This is one of the things in our notes. I'm like, it's like a Greek family dynamic. It's Jewish. It's Italian. It's like all of these
family dynamics are like crazy kind of in this wonderful way.
Everybody.
Every time, I mean, I always have readers come up to me and they're like, I know it's the Indians, but really,
it was
the
me.
The Jews.
Exactly.
The other thing I was thinking about when I was thinking about the casting stuff was, have you watched Masters of None or Master
yes.
of None?
Yes.
That the Indians on TV episode, like clip reel that he chose at the beginning, and then that whole episode in general about, you know, these like typecasting and that there just like aren't interesting roles for Indian actors in general. So this is the interesting roles. Okay, so Dimple.
I think Priyanka Chopra has to be Dimple. I think
that's a good call.
Right?
Yes, no, I'm with you.
One that I had really landed on.
Yeah. I have two ideas for Mina, which did take like me doing research and like digging. Hannah Simone, do you know who this? She plays Cece on The New Girl.
Oh, yes.
She's real cute.
Yeah, she is cute.
And has that sort of like long and like, lankiness.
Can she do kind of disaffected?
I don't know. That's what I don't know.
She's just so funny on The New Girl. But yeah.
And then Noreen DeWolf, who was on Anger Management and who was also in Ghosts of Girlfriends Past, a very highbrow film.
Fantastic.
I'm kind of going on looks for these, which is what I do when I cast things in general. But I feel like they both look the part and seem to have like the chops to do it. And then for Sanji, this is not going on looks at all. Do you know Kalinda on The Good Wife?
Yes.
I feel like she's like the right amount of like just like zesty, whatever. She could also make a good Kamala, but She's too young for that role.
Archie Punjabi. Yes. You're right, though. She has that way. She could also, frankly, make a good Bala if she went.
Yeah. Totally.
If she kind of skewed that way. Because I feel like she can do really funny. She can do really in your face, and she can do really brittle, like, I'm going to ice queen you a little bit.
Exactly. And then I really decided I needed to cast Jamie.
Oh, good. Who's Jamie?
Rob Pattinson. That's a girlish mouth.
That is a girlish mouth.
Are we going to dye him blonde?
I think so.
I also like how we're going by him as Rob now. I was like, who's Rob Pattinson?
Oh, yeah. My old friend, Rob Pattinson, would be perfect for this
film.
Buddy
Rob.
I'm Harvey Weinstein.
one name only, just Rob.
That's what I have written down. Rob Pattinson.
Perfect. I buy it, though.
Yeah. He's also actually 30.
So, age appropriate.
I was trying to be really. Yeah.
You were really nailing it.
I was trying to.
Here's age appropriate.
Yeah. But who are your thoughts?
You must have cast Amina.
Amina is the one that I can't cast.
Yeah.
That's the one that I just. It's like that person that you keep wanting to find, but this person's too sunny, and that I just want a moody person who telegraphs like deep empathy. Right. I don't know how to find that person.
I did think, and Erica didn't quite agree with me, but I was like, I think Mindy Kaling in her first dramatic role, because in the more dramatic moments of the Mindy Project, she's so funny.
I don't know.
I just always love a comic turned dramatic.
Really. Yeah, I feel like Mindy could also be a really good dimple.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Totally.
I mean, she's got the sass.
Yeah, it's kind of a.
We need a broody. Yeah. We need someone broody, and I don't know who that person is.
Someone who can say something without talking.
Yeah.
We should go to commercial for a minute because we've totally forgotten that we meant to do that.
We'll do that quickly. Okay.
We're almost done.
So we've been shopping at Bed Bath & Beyond for a gazillion years, just like everybody else out there, at least as recently as college, which is when I can remember, because I remember running into my crush and his mom in the parking lot of Bed Bath & Beyond while we were both shopping for college things. But I think I've been shopping there even before then. It's good stuff.
It's a classic.
It is a classic.
But now that Of A Kind is part of the Bed Bath & Beyond family, Bed Bath & Beyonce, as we are trying to rebrand it.
Why not, though? It's a good one.
I feel like
Beyonce would be fine with it.
Totally.
She wouldn't ask for money at all.
Mm-mm. We've gotten to spend a lot more time exploring all of the crazy impressive products that the store carries, and we've honed in some of the greatest hit, the sort of timeless, classic, pretty stuff that we want filling our cabinets and our closets.
If you're not heading there for Japanese knives, for the Le Creuset Dutch ovens, for the Miele vacuums, for the Freta bedding, what are you doing?
Get over there.
They have all that stuff.
Yes. Get your butt to a store stat.
And sign up for their newsletter stat, because guess what? You get a 20% off coupon for a single item. Boom.
Hi, we're back.
We're back.
You are listening to A Few Things with Claire and Erica, the Reading Things episode.
Yes. We're talking with Mira Jacob from A Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing.
She's from the pages of this novel.
No, she created it. She wrote it.
That would be so weird if I was also from it. I just created myself.
Just so creepy. So the name of the book, it's Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing, is a reference to, well, really specifically this uncle who is only in the book briefly, who both sleepwalks and dances. But sleeping is a big theme throughout the book. For a lot of the characters, where did that come from for you?
Yeah, you know, I think that came up. So there's sleepwalking, there's narcolepsy, there's insomnia, there's all sorts of sleep trouble running through this book. And it made a lot of kind of just intuitive sense to me when I was writing it. Because what happens when you're an immigrant, especially first wave, right?
Yep.
And you are the Indian. No one else knows the other Indians. So you are representing that in the world every day. The thing that you try to do is just adapt American mannerisms. And I remember this really when I was young, just watching people and aping them so that I would look more like them and I would hold myself more like them. And I would kind of practice strutting in mirrors the way that I thought Americans would strut. And it made sense to me because sometimes after you do that and you spend all day doing that, you're just tired.
Mm-hmm.
You come back to your home where you're just yourself again. Mm-hmm. And it feels like taking off a heavy costume. And it made sense to me that what you would have in that moment and the disease that could kind of travel continents are the diseases of sleep, right? So your body is just sort of wreaking havoc on you because it has been so constrained during the day. It has been so forced into a shape that it does not want to be in that by night, your subconscious is just taking over and running rampant and just, you know, kind of going wild with you because you've been ignoring it.
So do you think that the sleep troubles that these characters experience are symptomatic of that?
Yeah, I do. I think it's all symptoms of various levels of unhappiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's also the thing that happens.
And like conformity.
Conformity. And, you know, Sunil's a sleepwalker because
he's a dentist.
He hates his life he can't stand it. And there is a glimmer in there at some point early on that he could have been, you know, a dancer. He has that feeling about him. And that thing has been so squashed in him.
Yeah.
When Claire wasn't crying when she was reading the book, she was thinking about food.
I love Indian food, but B of all, like, stopped to Google so many of the food things,
so interesting. You are just like that as a reader and consumer of anything. I don't stop to Google anything
when
I read.
The food was such a central piece of this, and I, you know, I was feeling the book so viscerally, and I found myself at points reading the name of a food and just assuming that it was like an Indian dish I was familiar with, and I was like, no, I want to get this right. It felt like you were so precise and deliberate about the foods that it felt worth knowing or at least trying to have a sense of what they were in that moment.
That is very thoughtful of you.
I was crying. I was like feeling. I was like, I've already got the full body thing going. Let's go.
You're like, what is masala dosa?
Exactly. Is that just a product of like of your upbringing and food being central to you, or was that?
And I used to cook professionally, and I think in our house we sort of do medicate a lot through food, like. My mother's fantastic cook and would sort of deliver different kinds of food based on, you know, what was happening. And there's tea. Anything tragic happened, it was like, first get the tea on, then we'll deal with whatever it is. But literally, like, people could be shot and bleeding in the living room and it'd be like, well, put the tea on and then we'll deal with this.
Did your mother ever go through a phase of making French food?
She didn't quite do that, but every time my mother, you know, she's a great cook now, but there were times where she would venture out of Indian food with like terrible results. And in fact, the mashed potatoes, there's a scene in mashed potatoes, that was actually from my childhood. My mother somehow thought if you put 3 sticks of butter into the mashed potatoes, that would just be better, like better and better and better.
I actually follow that logic. You can tell your mom.
And we couldn't breathe when we were eating them because what happens is it somehow it becomes some sort of like epoxy.
It's like a glue.
If you swallow, you can't breathe afterwards. So we learned that the rough way. But yeah, you know, a lot of it was, I was watching her. She's a really interesting cook and she's sort of fearless. Mm-hmm. And I loved that about her. But I also felt like Kamala wouldn't be able to do any of that. Kamala was really different. My mother was actually really cool. My mom was a feminist. My mom, when she realized I was having problems with like girls and girls, mean girls, she took me to see Heather's.
That's a pretty good prescription for that.
It was so good. Yeah. She's like, I don't know. I think this could be good for yourself. And then we sat and watched it and, you know, everyone's blowing up and killing each other. She's like, well, I find that quite good.
Great, mom. Something else that occurred to me that came up with in this book multiple times were like items of clothing. Itty's shoes and Akhil's leather jacket. Was that intentional, or what is your relationship with these sort of objects?
A lot of times, so I draw a lot, and a lot of times when I don't know what to do with a scene next, I'll try to draw an object from it or from the person, just to, you know, it's that thing of, I feel like creativity flourishes best when it's given constraint, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And part of giving it constraint is also like a task can be a constraint. Mm-hmm. So in other words, like if you have something creative that you're trying to work out, if you go fold laundry, a lot of times you'll be like, and now I know. And it'll just come to you because in the act of busyness, you release the part of your brain that is hell bent on trying to figure out the perfect answer. And all of a sudden it's like, no, it's not that answer. It's this one. Right. So a lot of times what I'll do is I'll draw so that that part of my brain that generates the story will relax enough to generate it.
Yep.
And so those objects then became kind of totems for people.
Yep. Hmm.
So the shoes with Itty came first, and I just kept seeing them everywhere, and I kept drawing them, and I was like, these are really dopey shoes. Like, why do I keep drawing these? And then Akil's leather jacket kept flashing up. And then I did this. There's a point at which there's a mural.
Yeah.
It's a reimagining of Rushmore.
And
that came in a flash, and I drew that first.
Oh, wow.
But that was, so those things are what kind of made the story happen. Like, I had to draw them, and then I would write them into the story.
That's so cool. Erica has a really good list of books that she was sort of like, if you, a Netflix style
it's
recommender.
An algorithm, actually.
Yeah. You used an algorithm.
And the algorithm is books I've read that feel similar to this book in some way.
Feel play on the themes of them.
Yeah, exactly. But I would like your contributions as well. So there are a couple. If you like immigrant stories, that seems like the most insane way to
but
set
Netflix
this up.
Would totally say that.
They would. Netflix would be like, this is
immigrant
perfect
stories
for you.
With a strong central female character.
Netflix would be like, if you like brown people.
Exactly.
So a few ideas. This one you actually did also call out, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde.
Yes,
by Juno Diaz, obviously. Another one that feels sort of obvious, especially in the mother-daughter relationship kind of way, is The Joy Luck Club by Amy Tan. Mm-hmm. The Absolutely True Story of a Part-Time Indian by Sherman Alexie. Mm-hmm. Different kind of Indian, but... and then Blue Boy... by Rakesh Satyal.
No, nope.
I'm totally Rakesh. Rakesh.
Yes, good
I
work.
Wrote this. I. Oh my god.
Well, she
terrible.
Also fully like rehearsed the pronunciation with
Rakesh.
Me before,
but I'm sorry.
You did a great job. You nailed it the second time.
Embarrassing.
Around.
and then Family Stories. Fun Home, which Claire and I are both obsessed with and saw.
So
did you see? Have you seen the play?
I haven't seen the play yet.
It is
really
so good.
Really?
It's that same like tragic funny. It very much nails the tragic
and
funny thing that you do.
Father-daughter relationships.
Yes. Yeah. And it was a graphic novel. So
I know.
Yeah.
I've been looking at it a lot lately.
And then this one's the one that like really felt right to me of all of them. This Is Where I Leave You by Jonathan Tropper. It's also a movie starring Jason Bateman. So, but basically the main character goes through this like life crisis and then goes home because his father dies and just sort of sits Shiva and deals with the dynamics of the entire family being there and all of their shit kind of coming out and him just dealing with like the trauma of, you know, his personal life surfacing as well.
Nice.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
Yeah, it's very good.
Wow.
It's very good.
I have a question for you that I'd like to end on. It's very self-serving, but a lot of our listeners are in New York. What's the best Indian food in New York?
Oh, good one.
Oh, wow. Oh,
or LA
man.
Or San Francisco. We got people, you know, we're a global podcast. And by global, I mean America.
I'm both coasts.
So, I'm going to tell you, this is so not helpful because my mother is my mother.
Yeah.
Like there,
you're not allowed to do this.
No, I'm not. I'm not really allowed to do this. Like I can say like the safe things, like Jackson Diner's always a good bet. Right. You know, I can say that stuff, but like I'll be kicked out of the family.
You can't say it with Harvey. Yeah.
No, I mean they'll be despair.
Do you have any books? Because you, I'm sure, are a very prolific reader that you think sort of speak to some of the themes that you get at.
Have you read The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy?
No.
So I would this book be some, but it's about a similar community.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have there are slight leaps into magical realism, though it doesn't live there either.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think is a good one. And have you read Behind the Scenes at the Museum by Kate Atkinson?
I have read Kate Atkinson, but I haven't read that.
Okay. That is one of my favorite books, and that book is just this heady, crazy. You are in a sprint. You are in the head of a narrator. This is a great book. The head of a narrator who knows absolutely everything. Like, it starts with her father and her mother conceiving her, knows everything.
Wow.
Can see everything except for this one scratch in her memory, this one big hiccup in time that has left her life devastated. And you kind of roll through it, keep getting this feeling that something is missing, and you figure out what it is.
Hmm.
But it's brilliant. And the pacing of that, I loved it. And the feeling in that. And the other book that I love just for the way it plays with race, and I took a lot of courage when I was writing my own stuff, is Zadie Smith's On Beauty.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also just because I think she loves language, and it's really fun to read somebody who loves language. But I also just like the kind of weightlessness with which she handles race. It's not incidental, but she just sort of says it in very plain ways and lets it live on the page as it is.
She doesn't try to be like super delicate about
it. And she doesn't try to explain it to people that aren't going to get it, which is my pet peeve of writing and having people kind of say, like, I really wish you would have said more about that. And it's like, well, you can go read that on Wikipedia. And I can just write a story.
Claire can Google what that dish is.
That is right.
Thank you so much for coming on. This was amazing.
This was so much fun. I loved your questions. Oh, I feel good. Like everyone should be so lucky to be here. That was great.
You've been listening to A Few Things with Claire and Erica. We're not announcing our next book club on this episode because we don't know when we're going to air the episode yet. So stay tuned. But in the meantime, go back, listen to old episodes, review us on iTunes, sign up for our newsletter.
Find us on Stitcher too.
Yeah.
iTunes, Stitcher, Heritage Radio Network.
Ofakind.com.
Where you can also spend all your money, and you should.
That's it.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.